You are Locked On Celtics, your daily Celtics podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
And I'm so hyped right now. Anything's possible. Oh, my mama. Oh, my mama made it, man. Anything's possible.
Rainy days, jump shot, fade away. This the best Celtics podcast day to day. I get excited about it every night about it. A real C's fan wouldn't want to live their life without it. Banner 18 in the making, we gotta make it. Best squad in the East and still we can't get complacent. Most winning franchise, so the history's ancient. You could tell them other guys to go and plan a vacation. Yeah, Corrales, Packard, and Jay King. Locked on, trying to get the 18th ring. The most in-depth coverage that you ever gonna hear. Well respected in the city like Russell's career. It's Raining Jays. Raining Jays. Millie.
Welcome back. This is the Locked On Celtics podcast, and I want to thank you for making us part of your daily routine. We're here for you Monday through Friday, and this is the Tuesday show. Hope you enjoyed the long weekend. If you're going to work, getting ready for work, at work, thank you. Thank you for including us. I am John Corrales of the Rain and Jays. I cover the team for Mass Live on Twitter. I am RedsArmy_John. If you're new to the show, if you haven't subscribed, go ahead and do so using the new Himalaya podcast app. Download that. Subscribe to Locked On Celtics. Find us wherever podcasts exist. Or get in your car, ask your smart device to play podcast Locked On Celtics. I'm here by myself just for a minute because coming up, I have a long conversation with the New York Times' Sopan Deb. He is their new NBA reporter. We've talked to Sopan a couple of times here on the podcast in the past. He has an interesting kind of rise to this position because he started off covering politics. He was embedded in the Trump campaign, and then he went to the New York Times to be their culture reporter. And from there, they got him into the NBA. He's a huge NBA fan. He's a big Celtics fan. And now he covers the NBA for the New York Times. That conversation is coming up. First, quick rumor that popped out there. I wrote about it on MassLive.com. Always go to MassLive.com/Celtics for all of the latest Celtics stuff. I do a lot on there. I've included today the top 20 NBA free agents that are available. Be sure to check that out. But this rumor, in quotes, comes from Chris Broussard, who I admit has, we'll call it a spotty history, but Anthony Davis, Kyrie Irving, Brooklyn Nets. The Brooklyn Nets, according to Broussard, are making a big play for Kyrie and Anthony Davis. The reason I bring it up is mostly to knock it down that Broussard's out there saying, first of all, that the Nets want to pair Kyrie and Anthony Davis. Fine, I'm sure they do. That's a great pairing. Most teams with that kind of cap space would like to pair Kyrie Irving and Anthony Davis. Can they? They could, except Kyrie is going to sacrifice how much money? A lot. Like, starting salary for him in Boston would be somewhere around $32 million. Starting salary in Brooklyn would be somewhere around $27 million because he would get 30% of the cap in Boston and 25% of the cap in Brooklyn, and 5% raises in Brooklyn versus 8% raises in Boston. So that money adds up pretty quickly. He'd be giving up a lot of money to leave a team that could trade for Anthony Davis to then go to another team that could trade for Anthony Davis. So why would he do that? Maybe he wants to be closer to home. That whole draw to New York, maybe he would be passing up a ton of money to do that. You can use some of the money that you're making in Boston to charter a private jet that can fly from Boston to Newark very, very easily. Let me tell you something. Going from New Jersey to wherever in New Jersey to Newark Airport is a lot easier than going into the city, going into Brooklyn, finding parking, or even if it's a car, like it takes almost the same amount of time. It's only like an hour flight to go from Newark to Boston. You're going to be getting an hour drive to get into Brooklyn. It just, whatever. If that's how you want to do it, fine. But buy a plane, charter a plane. You've got the money. It's cheap for you. It's not a big deal. Going into Brooklyn to do that, I don't know. Maybe he wants to. The really asinine thing was that with a straight face, Broussard tried to say that, quote, the selling point to Kyrie, and one thing I'm told he's looking at, is you don't have to deal with the media as much in Brooklyn as you do with the Knicks. As if the New York media would be like, eh, you know, Kyrie and Anthony Davis are over there, but we don't care about the Nets, so we're going to sit here and still cover the Knicks. Maybe you get Durant. Like, if Kyrie and Anthony Davis go to the Nets, they're going to add staff. They're going to add writers. They're going to hire people specifically to cover that team. That becomes a major, major story. That becomes a story that all of a sudden New York becomes the hotbed for all of basketball again. That if, and especially if the Knicks get Durant, and now you've got Durant, Davis, and Kyrie all playing in the same city. Holy shit. Can you imagine? Media like crazy. ESPN would move people. Like, I don't think Tim Bontemps would be living in Boston anymore. He'd be going to New York. They would station people around that city. That media contingent would grow, double in size. Don't think you can go hide. Don't try to tell me, Chris Broussard, that this dude's going to go hide in Brooklyn to be away from the media. Like, these reporters don't have Metro cards. You can take the subway to Brooklyn. I mean, come on. It's easier to cover the team in Brooklyn. The New York Knicks practice facility is in Westchester, which is outside of the city. It's easier to get from Midtown Manhattan onto a subway out to Brooklyn at the Barclays Center and the new Nets practice facility. That's an easier thing for them to do. I mean, the things that these people will say, I don't know what Broussard's trying to sell or who he's trying to help or what sources he's trying to advance, but sometimes they say some of the dumbest things. So that's a rumor that you've seen. That's a rumor that I kind of said a lot of the same stuff on Mass Live. It's crazy rumor season. We're going to talk rumors when we come back after the break and a lot more things with Sopan Deb of the New York Times. Again, if you're a new listener, please subscribe to the show. Download the new Himalaya podcast app. Do that. Subscribe to Locked On Celtics. Get this show delivered to you the instant it is ready. You don't have to wait for my tweets. You don't have to wait for it. Just pops up by downloading the new Himalaya podcast app. Back after the break with Sopan Deb. Sopan Deb from the New York Times. You are out in the Bay covering, getting ready to cover the NBA Finals.
I am in the Bay. That's right.
How's it going over there?
It is very unusually chilly, actually, which I guess is not unusual for San Francisco, but that it is indeed kind of chilly out here.
Is it supposed to be chilly this time of year? I feel like this should
apparently,
be. Like,
apparently, this is how it is out here. Apparently, it doesn't get warm for a little while, and even then, it doesn't even get that warm.
That's surprising. I don't know why. I just assumed that California. I mean, I know it's not like Southern California, but I mean, it's still like whatever.
Yeah.
So, first, congratulations on this gig. I mean, I want to say new gig, relatively new.
I started in April, so about like a month and a half ago, maybe. Okay. Give or take.
Still new enough. What's it like on the NBA beat?
You know, I used to cover politics, and I covered the Trump presidential campaign, and you use a lot of the same muscles. So as opposed, you know, when you cover in basketball, you, instead of covering poll numbers, you're covering box scores, and you know, and the quality of flax depends on the team, and in politics it's dependent on the candidate. You're trying to find narratives that are developing over the course of a couple weeks. You know, you're trying to find good stories, you know, about individuals, just in the same way you would with politics. And, you know, instead, I mean, it's a little different, obviously, but instead of different, you know, dealing with vitriolic people that don't like your politics work, you're dealing with vitriolic fans instead. So, you know, it's very, I tell you, the overlap between covering sports and covering politics is, in terms of the muscles that you use as a journalist, are very similar.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. I mean, they always say that politics in Massachusetts is like a spectator sport. So I can see that there are definitely similarities. Is there anything that has surprised you as you've switched to the NBA beat full time?
Anything that has surprised me? No. Only because I was already so immersed in the sport before, you know, so there's not been too much of a learning curve for me. And that's not because of any ability I have. It's just that I was already eating a lot of this up before I started if that makes sense.
Yep.
So I never really, I'm sure I will be dealing with a lot of, you know, the learning curve is like going to arenas and figuring out where the press entrance is,
right,
that kind of stuff.
Right, right.
And where do you pick up credentials, and which arena has the best food, and which, and meeting the other reporters. That's been the real learning curve. But in terms of the actual job, I feel like I have been able to jump in okay. I mean, I don't know. My bosses might feel differently, in which case, you know, ignore everything I just said.
Well, no, I mean, just from seeing you around a little bit, I feel like you. I mean, it's pretty simple, really. You request the person, you go, you have your story idea, you do the interview, and you move on. But you know, you never know. Sometimes something when you're covering it from, because the New York Times, it's not like what I do or what Jay does. You're more big picture storytelling. You're on the NBA beat, but you're not minutia. You're telling something. You're looking for something interesting. Like, what's in the month and a half or so that you've had? What's been the challenge in trying to accomplish some of the things that you're trying to accomplish for the Times?
Yeah, that's actually, I mean, it's a good point, right? And part of the reason I haven't really had to deal with learning curve as I would if I was doing your job is that, you know, I don't have to go to every practice. I don't have to go to every shoot around. I'm parachuting into a lot of cities, you know, and we don't even like write off every game, you know, in the way that you do. Doing this job for a month and a half has made me appreciate what the local team beat reporters do a lot more, because they have the hardest job, because they you know, the players don't give them as much time as they give the Nationals, right? But I mean, it's true though, right? Like, if Rachel Nichols comes in, you know, to do an interview, you know, she's getting the interview,
right?
Whereas, you know, if you're around the team every day, even if you're putting in a lot of time and you're doing a lot of relationship building, it doesn't matter. You know, it's like your access is still, you know, kind of, you know, your access is still very, you know, limited. Right. So that this whole process actually made me appreciate what local beat team reporters do a lot more. To your question as to whether as to what, you know, the biggest challenge has been, it's that before this job, I was very focused on minutia. I was very focused on the day-to-day injury updates, the day-to-day play, the data. I was focused on what you're doing. You know, that's the kind of content that I was interested in.
Right.
Whereas with the Times, the challenge has been, okay, how do I look at this at 30,000 feet high? How do I get someone who doesn't follow basketball on a daily basis, how do I get them interested in this story? Whereas, you know, I think a lot of people that follow the league on a daily basis, like – my audience and Zach Lowe's audience are two different people.
Very different, yes. Yes.
You know what I mean? Before I started this job, I was in the Zach Lowe audience.
Yep.
And whereas now I have to kind of find the, you know, get in a hot air balloon and look down at the world, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, it does make sense. It's interesting because, we've known each other for a little while now. It's interesting that we now intersect in this world, considering where we both started. You started in politics. I started in news. We were Celtics fans in New York City. That's how we got to know each other. And now we're both covering the NBA. So it's an interesting little road that we've traveled. And to have isn't it wild? So then now you come into the Celtics practice facility and you have a thought in mind. You're going to talk to Jason Tatum. And it's interesting that I think you have obviously an advantage, like you said, like the national people come in with, okay, this guy's from the New York Times or ESPN is coming in, whatever, and that player is going to talk to you differently because they know, well, this is the New York Times. I'm gonna be a little bit more forthcoming, I think, or at least a little bit more open. That's my take. And
that may be the case. You're probably right, except I think it depends on the player.
Sure. Some players just won't talk.
Or some players are going to be open with anybody. Like I think, for example, Steve Kerr, you could be from the Bridgewater State College newspaper, right. Or you could be, David Halberstam, and he's going to talk to both of you and give you the same level of thoughtful answers. Whereas there are other players that it depends on the tag, and also part of it's also, the reporter, right? And in my case, I really pride myself in doing good interviews and getting and engaging with the subject as much as I possibly can and really getting them to dig deeper. And so I think a mistake that some reporters make is that they go in with their list of questions in mind, they ask the questions, and then they move on. And then they don't. And so I'm asking you a question. You give, maybe it's a generic answer or whatever. And instead of following up and be like, okay, come on, can you give me something more than that? You go, okay, well, box checked, going to the second question.
Right.
And I think asking a follow up question and listening to somebody, those are really underrated qualities for reporters. And I'm not saying that I'm necessarily, elite in that. I will say that I've had several interviews that I've gotten more out of because I've been, willing to follow up. And I've also had interviews that, by the way, that I regret not following up more on. And that is, and I've learned from those experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that speaks to, some people, they just don't know. They have a story in mind. They go, they're going to get the quotes that they need for their story. They're going to leave. Whether that means they're too focused on that story, they're nervous, or they're busy, and it's like I got all this stuff to do. I got to get in here. I got five quotes to get from Kyrie Irving. And okay, said that's good. Boom, I'm done. I got my story. I'm out.
And the way I look at it is, there's a difference between an interview and a conversation. Mm-hmm. I try to have a conversation.
Yeah,
and that's different. Now I will say, part of this just comes with as you do it more, you just get more comfortable doing it. Mm-hmm. And part of it for me also stems from having done politics. I've covered a presidential campaign. I've been yelled at by politicians. Like I kind of go into these interviews with basketball players and I go in my head, I'm like, there's nothing that this basketball player can say that will upset me. You know what I mean? Like, there's nothing that's going to rattle me with a basketball player because I've been in much harder situations than this, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that's an underrated thing just for people, like young people who might be listening who want to get into this business. There's an element here that you got to take yourself out of this, like, oh, man, I didn't like the way he said that. He doesn't seem to like me. I'm not happy about that or whatever. Like, you got to kind of get past that. It's easy to kind of get caught up in the, geez, this guy doesn't like me kind of mentality. Cause athletes don't like the media and you're not there to make friends, but you're also there to just kind of be, I always compare it to that scene in Ocean's 11 where Brad Pitt's telling Matt Damon how to be the fake, casino gaming guy, where he's like, be memorable but forgettable. Like you've got to be like the guy that can just walk up and just kind of generically have a conversation and then just leave and be like personable but not memorable. And
yeah, but the flip side to that is that the well-known reporters are the ones that sometimes have the best conversations, right? Like if Rachel Nichols shows up, the players are going to be better with her. You know what I mean? Doris Burke the national reporters, right? Sure. And like the guys, you know, if Mark Spears shows up, or you know those guys, you know the players know who they are and they're more willing to be open. But I do know what you're saying is that you're trying on some level, especially as a local reporter that has to be around the guys every day. You have to source manage a little bit and not step on his like toes every day. You know?
Right. Right. I mean, you can't just fly in and I mean you can, but I mean it's a different dynamic. There are a bunch of different kinds of reporters that can exist. You can be the hard ass. If you're the hard ass, but you have to be 100% fair. You can't be doing hit jobs all the time. And if you're saying something that's tough for a player to read, you got to make sure that you're available in there. So the player, if you need to confront the player, if the player needs to confront you, you can say, all right, tell me where I'm wrong. Tell me what's, and have a follow-up conversation. You have to be available to them. I think that's more on the local daily beat thing. It's an interesting dynamic of the beat writer, the columnist, the national writer, the national NBA beat writer, the national columnist. Like every person has a different kind of dynamic. And
yeah, and John, I will say, and this again comes from my presidential campaign day. I think what makes me effective as a reporter is I don't care about access. I don't care. Like I don't care if a player wants to talk to me or not. I don't care if a player doesn't like me. My job is not to get them to like me or care about me. And if you don't talk to me, you don't have to. I can still cover the sport effectively. You know what I mean? Because eventually we're all getting the same quotes anyway. And I've seen, I think, too many reporters in too many different fields sacrifice something to get access. And I'd rather not do that. I'd rather not have access to somebody in exchange for, you know, lessening the quality of my work,
right?
Or, you know,
or a,
you know what I mean?
I'm
yeah, right, exactly. Right. I don't, you know, so if I covered the Celtics on a daily day-to-day basis and no Celtic want to talk to me, you know, fine. I'm fine because of all the way analytics are involved now, because of all the video footage we have now with all the cameras around the arena, you know, because we're all getting the press conference quotes. We can cover teams effectively now without having that access.
Yeah.
Because and when you get the access, you're rarely getting anything that insightful anyway.
Yeah, I agree. And that's the thing that I think is most important for people to understand is if you care too much about the access, then I think you've compromised yourself as a reporter. Because
right.
then like to hear Jackie McMullen talking about, oh, my colleagues, I've had colleagues tell me I need the king, so they're not going to leave him off all NBA. Now, if you think he's a third team all NBA guy, then fine. But if you don't and you're going to give him that vote because he's so petty that he's going to look down the people who vote and say, oh, you didn't vote for me all NBA, well, screw you. Like that's.
Well, actually, John, and while we're on that, it's funny. My position has changed on this because the Times is a policy that we can't vote on awards.
Yep.
So that's the Times policy. And I used to disagree with that policy before I started the basketball beat. The way I always looked at it is like reporters, by being able to vote on these awards, can help actually ensure the integrity in the game, right? Because otherwise you're having players vote and coaches vote, and who knows what kind of motives they're voting with, you know?
Sure.
Secondly, reporters are watching more basketball, you know, especially, the Zach Lowe's of the world. They're often watching way more basketball than the players themselves are. I mean, how can they, right? They're playing 82 games a year. And you know, when they're playing, there's 11, 12 other games going on.
Right.
You know, it's hard for – so my position used to be the basketball, you know – The reporters are actually the most well-informed. They're reading the most about it. They know most about the analytics. They know who's playing. They know more about the game than they've ever known before. Okay. And you know, the NBA players, they don't have time to like peruse Synergy and peruse the analytics and understand which teams are actually playing the best defense and pace and, you know, all that stuff. So why shouldn't the reporters who are most informed make those decisions? With that being said, now my position is different, especially after seeing what happened with this all NBA voting and Jackie Mullen's piece. Look, at the end of the day, I actually can't believe that there are player salaries tied to all NBA voting. Right. That's actually shocking to me, and should not happen, by the way. And I think I'm thankful that the Times doesn't let us vote. I'm thankful that has never been in my hands.
Yeah, look, I agree, and that's just something that the NBA and the players decided to put on the media, and that's I've never had a vote, and maybe someday I will, but I think if you take it seriously and you vote with the right knowledge and the right intentions and not because you are afraid of LeBron James or you want to do a favor to a guy on your team and you want to curry favor with somebody and say, Hey, look, I voted for you third team all NBA. How about that exclusive? Like if you're, and there's too many people that do that and too many people that worry about that. I don't know what the answer is. Do you open it up to more people and hope that the larger sample can get to the better answer? Or do you close it off to a select few people and no local media? And it's only like select national people. Like, I don't know. What is it, a mix?
Well,
I don't know what the answer is.
I don't think you make it select national people. I don't think that's the answer. I don't think you have reporters do it all.
Yeah, but
you know, if I'm operating under your presumption that you have to have reporters do it on some level. I don't think you can limit it in any way. I think that would be. You have to kind of live with the fact that, you know, the Oklahoma beat reporter is going to put Russell Westbrook on the all NBA first team. You know what I mean? Like, and that's how it is. And there's nothing you can do. With that being said, I think one thing you can do, is that you can force votes to be made public.
They are.
Let me finish. Plus, I think reporters should be obligated. If you put in a vote for all NBA, I think there should be a publicly available, you know, 100, 200 word, you know, you should defend your vote and say exactly why you voted the way you did.
Sure. I mean, I think that's fine. I think some level of accountability, because like you go down all of these different votes to put like Kyrie Irving all defense, like, come on, like a second team.
Do we know who did that? Do we know who did that? The Kyrie thing?
We don't know yet. That's going to be revealed at the end of June, when they do all of the awards and they hand out the MVP and all that stuff. All of that voting will be made public. So we will find out. It's just, we don't know yet.
So, right. Look, I mean, yeah. So I think if you are filing an all-NBA vote, you know, for any category, there should be a publicly available graph or a piece, however long, you know, whatever, and you should have to defend that vote. And that's not just the case in basketball, by the way. I mean, for a Hall of Fame vote, for baseball Hall of Fame votes, I mean, like, you know, you should have to, if you have that kind of power, you should have to defend it.
Oh, absolutely. I look at these things. I just wish that, I don't know, maybe defending the vote and having to go out there and defend the vote is the way to just assure that the other players receiving votes doesn't get you Devin Booker on the third team All-NBA or Eric Gordon third team All-NBA. Like, whoever put that vote on, whoever had that as a vote, like, I don't know. You end up costing somebody like Klay Thompson money when you have Klay. Now, there's no guarantee he would have gotten the Supermax but he's eligible for one this year. And if
with that being said, John, you know, if you don't get to be eligible for Supermax, Clay is doing fine. A lot of these guys, they're
doing fine. He's doing
$30 million. They don't need us to defend them on this. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I mean, it's $30 million. I heard a story recently. This is baseball, but of a baseball player who was upset that he didn't get he didn't win a certain award because it was an extra $100,000, and he's making like millions. Like he's a $30 million or whatever year player, and
right.
he's upset about $100,000. Like in the end. These are guys who are they're going to stop making this money at some point around 35. Like at 35 years old, you or somewhere in that range, you stop making money for like or at least the bulk of your money. So you got to
right.
like kind of pile up. So if the opportunity is there for Clay to make $30 million, then that's $30 million. I mean, whatever it is after he take home and whatever, it's still money that. Who knows, down the road, he could turn that into an investment or whatever. Like, I'm not in a position. I don't want to be the guy that takes money away from somebody. They work to be in that position. And if somebody throws votes away and gives Dwayne Wade a second-team vote, somebody gave Dwayne Wade a second-team vote.
Is that happening? Someone gave Dwayne Wade a second-team vote?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's not a good one.
So, now, you've got – I don't know if that you can count up the votes and get Klay Thompson enough – to get him into the third team, the math may not work anyway. But I don't want to be in that position. So
yeah,
it's an interesting position that we as writers find ourselves in. Okay, let me take a break. We just talk and talk and talk. We all of a sudden I look down at my clock and we're talking for 20 minutes. Like, oh shit. I don't want to keep you forever. Why don't we take a break and come back and actually talk about the Celtics?
Yes, please.
All right. Why don't we do that? Stick around. We'll be right back in the Locked On Celtics podcast. All right, so, Pam, we are in the middle of rumor season.
I personally
hate it. This is my least favorite time of the year. I don't know. Are you a big rumor guy? Like, do you love the rumors? Do you love this time of year?
No, I don't. No, I don't love I love free agency. I love trades. I think some of the most frustrating things as both an NBA reporter and an NBA fan is seeing the anonymous kind of transactional reporting that we see at this time of year. And so, do I hate rumors? I do, because usually, you know, it's one side that wants to have their spin out there, or they're trying to pressure front office. You have no idea how real it is. I love trades. I love free agency. I don't love the rumors that come with it.
Yeah. I hate them. I hate every, you know, what I really start to hate now is the Instagram, like, oh, this guy liked that picture. What does that mean?
I'll disagree. I hate it. I can't get enough. See, that's just because that's concrete. When LeBron James is liking, an Instagram picture of Kyrie Irving in a Laker uniform, that's a concrete. That's not rumor. That's the concrete thing that LeBron James is doing. LeBron James knows. LeBron James is a smart guy. He knows that everything he does is watched. And LeBron James, more than anybody, is a polished, very choreographed, very highly produced person. He does not do anything unless it benefits him or benefits the brand or gets him close to where he wants to go. So when he likes Kyrie Irving's picture on Instagram, he knows exactly what he's doing. That is not an accidental like. Oh, I'm just scrolling through my Instagram. Oh, funny picture. That is not what that is. You know what I mean? Like that I'm totally okay with. For the other stuff is noise, but that kind of stuff I can't get enough of.
Yeah, I still hate it. I still hate it. I get it. I'm not saying that you're wrong. but it's the thing that I hate the most. That just because, the following of the Instagram likes.
Let's take this, you know, one step further, which is like, read this a different way. Read this as like, what if that actually is LeBron recruiting Kyrie Irving? What if he never has had a conversation, you know, with Kyrie Irving, and you know, Kyrie Irving looks at his phone and sees a LeBron like the photo, and suddenly that's what sets this off. Think about how hilarious that would be. You know what I mean? And that's what I like to think about in those particular situations. Like, wow, that would be hilarious if that is actually how LeBron – if that in 2019, that's how you have to recruit free agency free agents under the radar.
That is such a high school – oh, my God.
Totally.
He liked this my photo. Oh, my God. Do you think he likes me? Oh,
yeah,
my God.
Right. You have to understand, the NBA is a very petty league. The petty every day, it's constant, it's on the court, it's off the court. It's a petty, petty league. And what LeBron James did was petty. You know, one of the most, you know, celebrated players that we'll ever watch in our lifetime did something very petty, because that's what we are in today's NBA.
It's wild. Let's, so as we sit here and think about the rumors and everything, have you developed your own personal feeling about what Kyrie may be doing? Do you think that there's anything to these rumors, any momentum at all, or is it just to you? Do you just see it as noise?
It's noise. Total noise. I mean, some of the stuff seemed a little outlandish, like Brooklyn wanting to team D'Angelo Russell and Kyrie Irving in the backcourt. Like, I don't see that, you know, being a good idea. But with that being said, no, I think it's all. I think there's probably less than 5 people in the world that know what Kyrie Irving is going to do in a month.
Yeah, I agree.
I get that we need to talk about it, and I get that, you know, we need to think about it, but I think that there is nobody really knows what's going on there, and who knows? The truth of the matter is, a lot can happen between now and July, you know, and July, right? And so, you know, Kyrie, you know, probably is thinking to, I mean, there's a chance he's thinking to himself, I need to see where everyone else goes first before I go. I need to see, you know, how the finals goes. Because maybe Kawhi, if Toronto loses, maybe Kawhi bolts Toronto anyway. You know, like all this stuff, you know, all the pieces aren't in place right now. And so a lot of this stuff is right now kind of, you know, useless speculation.
What would you like to see happen?
You know, as a Celtics fan, you know, it's, you want Kyrie Irving to come back. At the end of the day, he is at worst one of the top 15 players in the league. Okay. At worst. And whatever you can say about, you know, his bad playoff run, he had a great regular season, the best regular season of his career. Mm-hmm. And so there's that. I, you know, as a Celtics fan, how could you not want to see the team trade for Anthony Davis? You know, depending on what that package would be. Although I will say, with the Anthony Davis deal, who knows who has the best package? But you know, the Lakers getting the 4th pick really complicates things. For the Celtics, I think. But on the question of Kyrie, players like him, out of that caliber, don't become available very often. And he's available. And in more cases than not, you want to sign him and you want to make it work. Sure, was he, you know, did he make headlines that were not ideal? Yes. Was the flat earth stuff kind of a pain? Yes. You know, was his, you know, kind of moodiness and the slamming of his teammates in public not a great look? Yes. But at the end of the day, this is a league where talent wins out, and Kyrie Irving is a top shelf talent, and you want to bring him back. Now, let me flip that though. If Kyrie Irving doesn't come back, the Celtics have done such a great job rebuilding over the last couple of years that, okay, they're fine. Are they a championship caliber team? No, but they have a lot to build off of. They still have draft picks coming their way. They have emerging young players. I think Robert Williams showed that he's a future rotation player, no question about it, this year. So, like, if he leaves, you know, it's not like the Celtics as a fan base got all that attached to Kyrie to begin with, right? Like, it's not like I just don't think a lot of Celtics fans will be, you know, in tears if he leaves. I think they'd like to have him back, but they won't be devastated. The franchise won't be devastated.
Right. The Danny Ainge has built that team to remember. We've talked about the two concurrent paths that he's been building all along. You have one path where Kyrie and Al Horford and Gordon Hayward make you a contender today. Obviously this was prior to the Hayward injury, but what Ainge has been doing was, okay, you've got those three. They make you a contender. Brown and Tatum are the young guys that contribute on their rookie contracts. You get some other veterans on the bench and you have a contender now, whatever level of contender that is, whatever it was supposed to be, it is. And then once all of those guys age out, you've got the new guys. You've got Tatum and Brown who are now veterans. They're on their second deals. They're ready to lead you. Whatever picks you've made and everything are now ready to take you beyond that. And what the Celtics were supposed to have was a path of 7, 8, 9 years, 10 years of constantly being good. Whatever level of good, whether it's championship contender, playoff team, home court advantage, that's what Danny Ainge was doing. Sustained greatness, at least very goodness. Now, this past season changed a lot. First of all, the injury, the Hayward injury, changed a lot. Secondly, Kyrie being Kyrie and not being able to handle a lot of this stuff and being caught up in these rumors and now being on the fence about whether he wants to leave, that has changed a lot. The entire dynamic, that really one of the worst things that happened to the Celtics was making that run to almost getting to the finals last year because it pumped up everybody. I think this season would have been so much better if they had just lost to the Milwaukee Bucks last year. Because then Tatum and Brown and Rozier don't have that. Well, we got that far without you. Like, they come into the season like, okay, we really need you guys, and they much more easily fall in line.
But let me just push back here in that. Let's leave Terry Rozier out of that trio, because for what it's worth, Jaylen Brown went to the bench and he played great. Like, he handled it with so much professionalism. And he came back and he especially in the playoffs, Jaylen Brown goes to the bench and he handled it like a pro and actually played really well. Jason Tatum, look, he wasn't that efficient. You know, he had a worse shot selection, but he actually improved his overall game, became a better rebounder, became a better passer. Terry Rozier just tanked his value. He just couldn't hit open shots, couldn't operate pick and rolls, you know, routinely exacerbated those two things with making bad decisions, you know, poor shot selection and not being able to hit shots. So I'm not going to sit here and blame Terry Rozier for the Celtics bad season, but the fact is one of those guys could not accept their roles. I never think it's a bad thing for a franchise to go as far as they can in the playoffs. At the end of the day, you know, let's assume the Celtics invest in Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. That experience of getting to minutes with of the finals, I think that pays off long term. I think it's great for them to get more Game 7 experiences. I think it's great for them to get more playoff experiences. And it gives them a taste. Now they come back. And so it pumped them up for good reason. I think the Hayward injury ended up being a bigger killer for the Celtics than previously thought. Now, I don't think the story's finished with Hayward yet. You know, I think realistically, you're going to see more consistency from him next year. He had such a traumatic injury. He showed flashes this season. Next year is the year I think we're really going to see kind of the Hayward, not the Hayward of old, but the Gordon Hayward 2.0, who is effective on a night in and night out basis.
Yeah, let me go back to the other thing. I think the beginning of the season really set the tone here. I agree. Jaylen Brown.
In preseason, by the way, they looked bad in preseason. Yeah. They were 1-3 in the preseason. And right there, you could see, oh, this is going to take a while.
Yeah. Yeah, and Brad Stevens admitted as much. You could see it right away that I think from the beginning you had Jason Tatum. Like, it took Jason Tatum a long time, and I agree. Like, people say he took a step back. I don't think he took a step back at all. I think he did. You are right that he improved a lot of things. He didn't take as big a step forward as people had hoped, but I think part of that is just trying to find his place in this on this team. But the beginning of the season, you saw how many terrible mid-range shots, just up faking, stepping into or taking a bunch of dribbles and fade away isolation shots, like that type of thing. And the reason why I say that that prior season playoff run was more detrimental for this season was, well, Jason Tatum raises his profile. He goes and works out with Kobe Bryant. Kobe Bryant's getting him all gassed up, and he's trying to play like Kobe Bryant, and he's not Kobe Bryant, at least not yet, and he can't take the shots that he was taking. I think that hurt. Jaylen Brown did come around. He definitely was the one guy that adapted the best, for sure. Terry Rozier, I think, was a gigantic problem because the Celtics needed him. They needed him to play. They needed somebody to back up Kyrie Irving. Kyrie Irving never did anything on back-to-back days. His minutes were managed because of the marathon of the season. And I can't tell you how many times that Terry Rozier came in and played selfishly. And we heard after the season that he was talking about. He talked about thinking about his money. He talked about not being able to beat Terry Rozier, sacrificing his talent, quote-unquote. Like, that stuff really hurts a team, because now if he's doing that, then other guys start joining in saying, well, if he's going to do that, then the only thing I can do when I get the ball is not pass, because if I pass it, I'm not going to get it back. I talked all year long about these guys don't trust each other on the floor. They can be good friends in the locker room. I never saw any real discord in the locker room, but they didn't trust each other on the floor. Like, you watch the Warriors, man, they trust each other because they know you give that ball up, it's going to get to the right place somewhere. Somehow that ball is going to be in the right hands at the right time to get a good shot, generally speaking.
Yeah. I agree with all of that. I will say I appreciated Terry's honesty about this, because if we think that Terry Rozier is the only person on the basketball floor that's thinking about his money, you know, we're nuts. I mean, Terry Rozier is no different than any other basketball. He is thinking about his financial fortunes as any other player is. The difference is that Terry Rozier, in addition to thinking about his money, was not good. You know what I mean? Like, you can think about your money all you want. You can think about, you know, you could think about your own future. You know, Terry Rozier's own future would have been much more secure if he played well and hit the shots that he took, or even the open shots, or, you know, if he could execute basic basketball things like, you know, as we mentioned before, the pick and roll, you know. But with that being said, we shouldn't jump up and down on Terry Rozier, because at the end of the day, you don't lose and be one of the most disappointing teams, you know, in the last 10, 15 years because of your backup point guard.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, at the end of the day, if we're making a list of problems with the Celtics this year, Terry Rozier does not crack the top five, probably, you know? I mean, I think the bigger issues, right, were, you know, this is a team that could not get to the line. Okay, this is a league you score three ways, right? You shoot three-pointers, you dunk the ball, and you get to the line.
Right.
The Celtics could only do one of those three things. And Kyrie Irving could get into the paint, but even his, you know, kind of finishes were finesse finishes. They were falling away. They were, you know, he's not going up for contact. So the Celtics really had nobody. Gordon Hayward kind of came the closest, but the Celtics really didn't have anybody that could consistently get to the line and consistently penetrate. It was a jump shooting team. So when that happens, you are, you know, your team is going to be inconsistent. There are some nights your team's going to look like the best team in the league, and there are some nights when you can't beat the Knicks. You know what I mean? So that's one. I mean, the rebounding was an issue. You know,
the number one problem was their mentality. That was number one.
Sure.
Like, to me, number one, they couldn't mentally invest in this season.
And some of that falls on Brad Stevens. I mean, and
it
so
falls on everybody.
My point is, like, okay, that's three or four things we need. I don't know if Rozier makes the top five of things that went wrong this season. You know what I mean? Like, at the end of the day, you know, I would argue that Jason Tatum's shot selection probably might have hurt the offense a little bit more than Terry Rozier's did. You know, like, how many shots is Terry Rozier actually getting out there on the floor? You know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but at the end of the day, Tatum's out there playing 30 minutes, Rozier's out there playing 15 to 20 minutes. So there's a hodgepodge of problems that happened with the Celtics this year. I do think that Terry Rozier is not coming back. I don't think that he thinks that he's coming back. I think that when you give that kind of bridge burning interview after the season, I think both sides at that point had, you know, kind of realized at this point that Terry Rozier is not coming back to Boston.
Right. I mean, I would think that that's probably the case. So to answer your question, Terry Rozier took 8.4 shots per game this season. So it started with Kyrie had 18.5. Tatum had 13. Marcus Morris had 11.3. Brown, 10.7. Al Horford, 10.6. Hayward, 8.8. Rozier, 8.4. Smart, 7.1. So Rozier is really right in that mix. He's only taking a couple fewer shots. Like, Jaylen Brown took 10.5 shots per game. Rozier took 8.5 shots per game. So Rozier was getting enough shots up to have an impact on a lot of these other guys. Like, I don't want to pile on to Terry Rozier, because you're right that he's not the guy that was the biggest issue. My issue is the Celtics had a bad mentality. It starts with a lot of different things. And, like, Aaron Baines was just at some event with a bunch of kids talking about it, and he said we didn't build the right habits early. And it's something that Brad Stevens said after they lost to the Bucks. That starts with Kyrie Irving, but that also trickles down to everybody else, that they didn't do the things. Like, why they lost to the Milwaukee Bucks was when they got hit in the mouth, they reverted back to all of the things that they were doing during the regular season. And they couldn't do the things that Kyrie Irving said that they were going to do, which is, hey, when the playoffs come around, we're going to be better. I'm going to make sure of it. Like, and that falls on him, but also the rest of the team, the ball movement that I keep talking about. You talk about the specifics. They didn't get to the rim. They didn't get to the free throw line. But why? Why? Because they're so focused on just – Jay King put it perfectly. I want to make sure he gets the credit for this. They always took the easy way out. There was a good open three. Great. I'm going to take this open three. And you can sit there and look at it and be like, it's fine. It's a good shot. It's an open three. But looking back on it, they never really took the opportunity to say, okay, we're getting 30 open threes a game or whatever the number is. We're going to drive some of these when nobody's in front of me.
But, John, that's not where the league is today.
No, but it is, though, when you look at a guy who's got the ball on the wing and there's an open it's him on the at the 3-point line and there's 5 feet in front of him. Okay, I get it. You shoot that shot. But if you're shooting that shot an extraordinary amount of times without the benefit of drives, then what good is it? Like, the whole point of that shot is to, and the whole point of being able to get that shot, you've got to set that up by saying, I could drive on you. If you're going to close out on me, you can't sell out because I could drive by you. Or sometimes I'm just, you know what? I'm going to pass up this three because I'm just going to drive and see if I can't get a better shot, an and-one. And just give me the, because now I put a foul on your board, get us one step closer to the bonus. I make you weary because now you've got a foul and you can't defend me the same way. So that sets him up down the line. Like, now you got two fouls. You fouled me again. I drove. I was aggressive. Now you got to sit. Now I got your bench in there. And the starters are playing against a bench unit for longer, which makes it much more likely for them to score. Like, all of those things pile on. You can sit there and say, yeah, that was a good open shot. or you can take advantage of that space and attack and put pressure on that defense rather than let them sit there and say, well, maybe they'll miss, which they do 65% of the time anyway. So we'll just get the long rebound and run. And that to me was it's a mentality that I didn't like with these Celtics.
Yeah, you're not wrong, right? I mean, there's no way but where I disagree is that this starts with Kyrie Irving. This starts with Brad Stevens. You know, that's where it actually starts, right? He designed the offense. And I think Brad's a great coach, and this season does not change that for me, because you don't forget to coach in an off season. So that's not how that works. But look, I do think, Brad Stevens is very good at making adjustments. I think next season you're going to see a different, quote unquote mentality, no matter who is starting at point guard. Now, what is interesting is what the Celtics do with Rozier if Kyrie Irving goes somewhere else. Because that's an interesting question, because Rozier, in probably about as half his starts, maybe a little more, played significantly better as a starter than he did as a bench player.
Mm-hmm.
But does Danny Ainge entrust Terry Rozier with 82 games plus the playoffs? Or does he sign him and, keep him as a trade piece, So that'll be an interesting question going forward.
I think if Kyrie leaves and they're stuck, I wouldn't be surprised if they brought him back. I mean, business is business, and he can drop all the napalm he wants on the Celtics. He didn't call anybody names, so he didn't personally offend anybody.
No, of course not. Clearly,
I'm not saying that you said he did. I'm just saying.
No, I know. But clearly, the dispute seemed to be between him and Kyrie, and him and his role. If he comes back next year, it would be because his role is different.
Sure.
It's just a question of the question, I guess, is he good enough for a larger role? If he's not good enough for the smaller role, why would he be better in the larger role?
Well, the comparison I've been making, and it's not a great one for Terry Rozier, is Jeff Green. And when Jeff Green got like $9 million from the Celtics, whatever year that was, people were like, oh my God, how can you give Jeff Green this? It was after his heart surgery and everything. The Celtics were stuck. And if Kyrie leaves and everyone else comes back, or whatever, maybe not Mook, but if Kyrie leaves, they just don't have a ton of money. So if Al Horford comes back, maybe he can help them out. Like, I expect him to opt out and re-sign long-term for a shorter amount of money in year one. But still, who does that get you? I mean, maybe they could try to go out and free up enough money and get like a Patrick Beverley. I don't know. But I feel like the Celtics financially might be in a position where they're kind of stuck, and you give Terry Rozier 2-3 years at decent money, and you say, here you go, you're the starter, and Marcus Smart doesn't give a shit. So Marcus Smart will play wherever you need him to play, and that's how you go, and your best chance is to hope that Rozier can be starter Terry and be better and learns how to run a damn pick and roll. But the money that they can give Terry Rozier, whatever that, what is it? 10, 12, 15, whatever the number is, they can't give it to anybody else.
Terry Rozier, I'd be shocked if he got $12 to $15 million a year.
Yeah. You know what though? After last year's playoffs, man, he was in line for like 20, which is wild. Yeah.
I know the Terry Rozier hype train was going last year. I think today we have more information about players than we ever did before. I don't think any NBA GM, I think 12 was what he was going to get. I think now he might be in the $7 to $8 million range.
I don't know. We'll see. I mean, he might be now. I don't know what this summer is going to be like. It's going to be so crazy. All it takes is one. All it takes is one. And we've seen there are bad GMs out there. He was just after that playoff run, starter on a playoff run that went that deep. I think he was in line for a lot more money than a lot of us thought.
Yeah, you might be right.
So, all right. Well, look, I'm not going to keep you anymore. Any final thoughts that you want to, any final point you want to make before we go?
Yeah. We didn't really talk about it, but the draft is coming.
Yes.
And the Celtics, you know, they kind of had a, you know, not a horrible night at the lottery, not a great night. I am very curious to see how the draft goes for the Celtics because, you know, they're going to be moving hard on Anthony Davis. Okay. You know, they're going to be moving hard, you know, because they're, I don't think Danny Ainge wants to, you know, they lucked out in the Memphis deal, not conveying, but they have, I think what they have the 12th pick, the 20th and the 22nd. 14, 20, 20. That in this draft is, I mean, the value is just so minimal. So I'm curious to see what they do with that. Or, you know, are they going to use all three picks? Will they have a choice? Because I think you have a situation where Ainge might just, you know, trade one of those picks for a future pick and, you know, do a pick swap or something. Mm-hmm. I'm very curious to see what the Celtics do with this year's draft.
It really, I mean, so much depends on, like, so if you get Kyrie and Davis, I assume 14 is probably gone. Memphis pick is definitely gone. I don't know what they do with the other two picks. If they'll need them because they'll be giving up multiple players. They might try to get somebody useful. If they run it back, like completely run it back, they don't get Anthony Davis, but Kyrie comes back. Maybe they use one. Maybe they try to get somebody useful with 14 and draft and stash 20 and 22. I wouldn't be surprised if they at any scenario. Now, if Kyrie and Al both leave, then they make all three picks and just go young. And it's.
Yeah. Oh, God. If Kyrie and Al Horford are gone, I mean, that's they're going to use the picks.
Yeah. You kind of have to. Those are the three scenarios that I think. But I wouldn't be surprised if there are draft and stash type of guys. Everybody throws this name Goga, somebody or other, some big center that I don't really know anything about. But all I know is the name Goga. It's almost like a few years ago, you're like, oh, Dragon Bender. Ooh, I like that name.
Right. And a lot of, you know, I bet there's going to be a lot of chatter about Bol Bol.
Oh yeah, Bol Bol is that's a big one. Who may be available down there. I don't know, man. That's
I know. I hear you.
It's going to be wild. I think we'll know. My contention is we'll know at draft time whether Anthony Davis is going to be a Celtic, because I think you need to be making those picks, whatever number of picks for the New Orleans Pelicans. So I think we'll know. And if those picks, if there's no rumor, no murmur, no nothing on draft night, and it's all assumed that the Celtics are making these picks for themselves, then I don't think Anthony Davis is coming, at least not in the time frame that anybody really thought. And that leaves a lot of question marks about Kyrie Irving.
I'll actually push back. I don't think we'll know that. And the reason I say that is if this Anthony Davis comes to the Celtics, it won't be because of the Memphis picks or some low first round picks or a mid first round pick. It'll be because of Jason Tatum. You know what I mean? I don't think whoever the Celtics draft with these picks for this particular draft affects it all that much. It could, you know, the Pelicans couldn't pull the trigger. I don't think it stops them from pulling the trigger after the draft either.
No, what I'm saying is that I think if we see the Celtics make us the 14th pick, let's say, and somewhere in the broadcast they say, oh, well, this is the Celtics, there's a question about whether the Celtics are going to keep this pick. If somebody starts hinting, like, well, if we don't hear anything on draft night, then I don't think that, that's a signal to me. Not that that's the thing that gets the trade. I think that on draft night, we'll hear, well, the Celtics are making this pick, but it's going to go to New Orleans. And It's for Anthony Davis. They're making this deal. If it's quiet on draft night, then I don't know that that deal is actually happening. Like, because now my contention is that if they make the 14th pick, they will actually use that 14th pick to sign. They have to sign the guy because you can't make the trade until July 1st anyway, or June 30, whatever it is, when Kyrie opts out. So the Celtics have the opportunity to sign the guy and use that money to aggregate in the salary for the to make the trade work. So I think it's a little trick. I don't know.
I mean, as I said, none of us know anything. But we'll find out.
We will find out. All right, so Penn, I'm gonna let you go enjoy that nice, gorgeous San Francisco weather.
All right, man. Thanks so much for having me. I always love being on.
Appreciate it, man. Enjoy the finals.
All right, man. Talk soon.
Great conversation. Of course, it went longer than I expected because all the conversations go longer than expected, and we could have kept going. Kind of stream of consciousness, but fun nonetheless. Hope you enjoyed it. You can follow Sopan at SopanDeb, SopanDeb on Twitter. He's a good follow, rabid Celtics fan. Does some great work for the New York Times. Obviously, he's working for the New York Times, so he's going to do some good work there. Go ahead and check him out. Again, follow us, download the new Himalaya podcast app, subscribe to us on that, or wherever podcasts exist, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts. Get in your car, at home, use your smart device and ask it to play podcast Locked On Celtics. All of you people who are doing that, following us, subscribe, go ahead and give us that 5-star rating. Give us a good written review and tell everyone to listen to the Locked On Celtics podcast here on the Locked On Podcast Network. Yeah, Corrales, Packard, and J. King.